This lecture, entitled Life in Eretz Yisrael Under the Crusaders, Ayyubids, and Mamelukes, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas of Chaim David ben Harav Peretz, Olav HaShalom, Mr. David Weiss, of blessed memory. When Rav Moshe ben Maimon visited Eretz Yisrael in the year 1165, a subject we covered in our last lecture, Eretz Yisrael was still in the hands of the Franks, the Crusaders, the descendants of the original group of French and Norman troops that wrested Eretz Yisrael, as well as much of the Middle East, from the hands of the Seljuk Turks. Syria, including Damascus, had at this time also been wrested from Turkish rule, but was in the hands of Nur al-Din, a Syrian Muslim ruler. And Egypt continued to remain in the hands of the Fatimid dynasty. These are all subjects we touched upon in the previous lecture. About 2 years before the Rambam visited Eretz Yisrael and much of the Middle East was visited by a certain Binyamin of the Spanish city of Tudela in northeastern Spain, in what was then part of the Kingdom of Navarre. Setting out from Saragossa in neighboring Aragon, Rabbi Binyamin journeyed through southern France, Italy, Greece, Syria, and Eretz Yisrael, and finally arrived in Baghdad. On his return trip, he traveled through the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea, and returned back to Egypt via Nubia, today Sudan, and afterwards arrived home by way of Sicily in the year 1173. In all probability, Rabbi Binyamin was a merchant, and was therefore able to support himself throughout these long travels. Rabbi Binyamin's rich description of the communities that he had actually visited and of the other communities in which he had heard reports remains an invaluable source for historians. In fact, he's called the Jewish Marco Polo. Starting from page 1, we have quoted excerpts from Rabbi Binyamin's work as they relate to the state of Jewry in Eretz Yisrael and its environs during this period. The English translation begins on page 2. Acre is the Akko of Scripture and lies within the confines of the ancient tribe of Osher. It is now the town on the frontier of Eretz Yisrael. It lies on the shore of the Mediterranean Sea and has a large harbor which serves as the point of disembarkment for all of the pilgrims, and these are the Christian pilgrims, who visit Jerusalem by ship. A river called Nahal Kidumim, this is Nahar el, this is Mukatua, which is the Nahal Kidumim is associated with Shiras Devarim. This is about the defeat of the army of Sisera. Runs near the city. There are about 200 Jewish inhabitants. Rabbi Tzadik, Rabbi Yefes, and Rabbi Yonah are its principal leaders. If you recall from the last lecture, Rabbi Yefes accompanied the Rambam on his trip from Akko to Jerusalem and Hebron, some 2 years later. But he was one of the leading Rabbonim in Akko. And it continues on. From there, Capernaum, which is to Caesarea, the Goth of the Plishtim, of the Philistines. Now, Capernaum is a, which is in Hebrew, it's Kfar Nahum, was an ancient town on the northwestern shore of the Kinneret, or the Sea of Galilee, which played a significant role in early Christian history. I put the ellipses. I mean, he visited many places, but which are not necessarily of Jewish interest. So I have the ellipses here, and apparently mean that he, between Akko and Kfar Naum, there are many places that he visited. The association of the Goth of the Philistines seems to be incorrect, as Goths is really in southern
Israeli seems to be in the south of, it's associated with the south of the of Eretz Yisrael. And Caesarea is in the middle. He continues on to Caesarea, Caesarea. It is inhabited by some 200 Jews. And there are different manuscripts. So some have it 200 with a resh, and the other have it 10 with a yud. And some 200 Kuthians. The latter are Samaritan Jews, commonly called Samaritans. The city is beautiful and exquisite, is situated on the seashore. It is built by King Herod, who named it Caesarea, Caesarea, in honor of Augustus Caesar. From there, a half day's journey to Kakun, the Kela of Scripture. In this place, there are no Jews. A half a day's journey from there is St. George, the ancient Lud, or Luz. There's only one Jew, Adaya. It seems the Jews were quite adept at dyeing clothing, and even in areas where the Crusaders were intolerant of Jews, they would allow Jews to practice this craft. So we'll find, says that many areas that there are other Jews except for dyers. We can just continue. There was only one Jew, a dyer, who lives there. From there, one day's journey to Sebaste. This is the site of ancient Shomron, Samaria, where the ruins of the palace of Ahab, Ahab, son of Omri, the king of Israel, are still evident. It was a well-fortified city situated on a mountain. It has springs and land is richly watered. It is surrounded with orchards, vineyards, and olive groves. There are no Jewish inhabitants there. From there is a two-parsang journey. A parsang is approximately 2.5 miles. There are four meal in one parsa. A parsang. A meal is between 3,000 or 4,000 feet. So let's say it's 4,000 feet a meal. So 4 is 16,000 feet, right? which is close to 3 miles. If it's, or it's like something like 2.5 miles. So from there is a two-parsang journey to Nablus, the ancient Shechem. It is situated on Mount Ephraim. There are no Jewish inhabitants there. Again, there's ellipses here. From there he traveled a few places to Givon, which was in the section of Binyamin. From there, Givon, a three-parsang journey to Jerusalem, a small city fortified with three walls. It contains a numerous population composed of Jacobites. The Jacobites really refer to the Syrian Orthodox Church. Armenians, they had their own church. The Greeks, because the Greek Orthodox Church. The Georgians, they had their own church. There was a difference in belief, but which we touch upon in the previous lecture, between these different forms of Christianity. Franks, they represent the Catholic Church. And indeed, people of all tongues. It contains a dying house which is rented by the year to the Jews who purchase the exclusive rights of dying clothing. No other people are allowed the privilege of dying clothing except the Jews. There are approximately, and again, the translation is based on the manuscript, 200, and there in that manuscript it had a resh, or 4, which is a dalet. You could see very easily how the scribe made the copying error between a dalet and a resh. And it would seem to be only 4 Jews. They lived below the Tower of David at the corner of the city. And it continues on. Jerusalem has 4 gates, which he called the Gate of Avram, the Gate of David, the Gate of Tzion, the Gate of Yehoshaphat. This gate of Yehoshaphat stands opposite the place of the Holy Temple, the Beit HaMikdash. At present, there is a building which is called on the Templo Domino. Omar ben Al-Khattab has erected a large and handsome cupola over it, and nobody is allowed to introduce any image or painting into this place. Now, Rabbi Yemin seems to be referring to the domed octagonal building in the Mokama Migdash, where the temple of Beis HaMikdash once stood, which he attributes to the Caliph Omar, who reigned between the years 634 and 644. It was Omar who was the one who conquered Jerusalem. Historical records, however, attributed to the Caliph Abd al-Malik, who finished it in the year 691 or 692. Earlier, under the reign of Muawiyah, who reigned from the year 661, an open-sided hexagon topped off with a cupola, a dome, was built in the exact middle of the Temple Mount to the east of what became the Dome of the Rock. It's called the Dome of the Chain. But he seems to be assuming that it's a building. He seems to be referring to what we would call today the Dome of the Rock. And it continues on. They come there, however, to pray. This is about the Gentiles. In front of it is the western wall, Kosel Maravi, one of the walls which formed the Holy of Holies of the Beis HaMikdash. It is called the Gate of Mercy, at least at that time it was called. And all the Jews come there to pray near the wall in the courtyard. Now, for years, it was a common understanding that Kosel Maravi, or the Western or Wailing Wall, was either the remnant of the wall of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, the Western wall of the Heichal, the main building of the Beis HaMikdash, that housed the menorah, that building housed the menorah, the Shulchan, meaning the gilded table, the Mizbeach HaZov, the gilded incense altar. Or perhaps that was one theory, and that seems to be what this Binyam of Tudela maintained. Or perhaps it was a remnant of the wall of the Har HaBayis, the Temple Mount. Research has shown, however, that the area which is surrounded by the wall is much larger than the original Temple Mount, which was 500 amas cubits by 500 amas, an area approximately between 750 and 1,000 feet squared, depending on the length of the amma, the cubit. Is the original, that which is described in the Mishnah of Midos, is a is an area of 500 by 500. The length of the western wall, however, with its Herodian stones, is 1,590 feet long. Evidently, the western wall is surrounding an area much larger than the original Har HaBayis, Temple Mount. The truth is, as Josephus wrote in his Antiquities, that Herod expanded the Temple Mount on the west and the south beyond the original Har HaBayis Temple Mount. Consequently, it would seem that the walls would have no intrinsic sanctity, unlike the original 500 by 500 amas of the Har HaBayis, which is considered to be the equivalent of Machna Leviya, the camp of the Levites, which originally surrounded the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and has certain restrictions of entrance. But this larger area, it would seem, does not have, at least that which goes beyond the original Har HaBayis, really does not have these restrictions. I mean, to this day, there's a question about entering the Temple Mount, like from the south. And according to this understanding, that really, when they're entering the Temple Mount near the Al-Aqsa Mosque, that area was not part of the, at least that's the argument, not part of the original 500 amas by 500 amas. And therefore, there are less restrictions in that area.
But that's only one
Yeah, there's only one part. I mean, they have to be careful where to go.
But that's only according to one person.
Well, in any case, we see that the area is much larger than that described in the Mishnah, which seemed to support the narrative of Josephus, that really it is an expanded area which was expanded by Herod. In addition, although the Medrash speaks of the Romans toppling the walls of the Har HaBayis, the Temple Mount, and leaving over the western wall, the story described there is that the job of toppling the walls from the platform were given to different Roman generals to take their troops and to knock over the walls. The general who was assigned to knock over the western wall did not follow orders. He was killed, but the western wall at that time remained. This is the western wall of the what seemed to be the expanded Temple Mount. Now, when the Medrash was written, which is in the 4th century, it's quite possible that wall was still standing. That wall is no longer standing. The present wall surrounding the Temple Mount, which we have again, so that Temple Mount, there has to be some sort of a wall or people would just fall down, was built much later by the Muslims. The wall of the Kotel Maravi that we have, you know, you go in the plaza, is not the wall of the Temple Mount. In other words, but rather a retaining wall. When Herod expanded the platform of the Har HaBayis, because in order to expand that area, he needed to build an artificial mountain on the west and south sides. To that end, Herod built large walls at a distance from the original platform of the Har HaBayis and filled in the area between the new wall and the original Har HaBayis wall, the original Har HaBayis, with massive amounts of dirt and debris until it reached the height of the pavement of the Har HaBayis, of the original Temple Mount, and thereby extended it. It stopped at a certain place, and he wanted to extend it. He built another wall, filled it up, and then put pavement stones there so you could walk there. Such a wall is called a retaining wall. Now, that wall may have well continued up well beyond the height of the pavement and served as a real wall as well, because it just kept on going up. So it could be that wall that started well below kept on going up. But that part of the wall that was used as a wall for the platform is no longer there. And all that is left is only the portion which is the retaining wall. So it's really not a true, when we speak about a wall of the Har HaBayis, we generally think about there's the area where you walk, and then there's the mountain, the wall, to give it security, to give it privacy. That wall is no longer there. What we have today is really just the retaining wall that he built to create this artificial mountain. Now, the Medrash speaks of the fact that the Shekhinah never left the western wall. Could be when that Medrash was written, when that wall, at least the expanded wall of the expanded Har HaBayis, was still intact. It could very well the Shekhinah still remains there, where the wall once was. But the truth is, there is no more true Western Wall. And it really comes, there is a nafka mina, it comes to really, there is a real question that was raised over the years about putting your fingers inside the wall. And if a person is would be tome, would be ritually unclean, and he had not gone to the mikvah, if he couldn't walk, that person walk, be on the top of the platform or be on the wall, there's a question, does the wall itself have kedusha as well, of sanctity? And that's why there were many people who were very careful not to put their fingers into the wall. If it's only a retaining wall, however, as well as an artificial mountain, and it has no Kedusha, then it would be no problem. Now let's continue on. And it continues on. We took excerpts here where those areas which relate to the Jewish community. And it continues on. Very little spring water is found in Jerusalem, and consequently its inhabitants generally drink rainwater which they collect in cisterns in their houses. And it continues on. In front of Jerusalem there are three Jewish cemeteries. Like another text reads, about 3 mil from Jerusalem lies a Jewish cemetery. Again, because of the discrepancy in the manuscripts, it's hard to know. And he continues, as they buried their dead in burial chambers, crypts, every grave had a dated inscription. This is what he writes. The people, referring to Christians, came and destroyed these monuments and used it as building material for their houses. And it continues on. From there is a two-parsang journey to Bethlehem, which is called Beth-Leon of Edom. A half mile's distance from Bethlehem at a crossroads is the monument over the grave of Rachel of Rachel. It comes as timely as this week's Sedra, Parshas Vayechi mentions again about the burial of Rachel. The monument is constructed of 11 stones. Again, this is translated from the manuscript. Equal to the number of the children of Jacob, which is questionable. He had 12 sons. It is covered by a cupola, which rests on 4 pillars. And again, that which, now it's really changed because of security considerations. But the old picture that you have of the dome building, that was really built by Moses Montefiore. In the middle of the 1800s. But he describes what it was then was really 4 pillars and a dome on top. And every Jew who passes there inscribes his name on the stones of the monument. In Bethlehem, there are 2 or 12 Jews, again, the question of the manuscript, who are employed as dyers. Probably it's 2. The country abounds with rivulets, wells, and springs of water. And then he continues on. He went to Hebron. And he says, from Hebron, there's a 5-parsang journey to Beth Guvrin, which is the ancient city of Maresha, where there are 3 Jewish inhabitants. You notice, as we're talking, there are not many Jewish inhabitants here. I'll just give you a sense of what life was then. And then, again, I'm skipping. And then from there, he went to Ramla. Now, Ramla, at one time, was a major city in Eretz Yisrael. From Ramla, there is a 5-parsang journey to Jaffa, the Yafo of Scripture. It is on the coast, and there is 1 Jewish inhabitant. He is a dyer. And then we're skipping. And then he describes he went to Tiberia. In Tiberias, Tiberia had some 50 Jewish inhabitants. And it's headed by Rabbi Avrom, the seer or astronomer, Rabbi Muchter, and Rabbi Yitzchak. There's hot water there, which gushes forth from the ground, and they call it Chame Tiberia, the hot springs of Tiberias. And then he continues on. He describes he went to the Banyas, which is the headwaters of the Jordan. There's a 2-day from there, from Banyas to Banyas to Damascus. Now, I just want to say, you'll find what is the contrast now between Damascus and the cities of Eretz Yisrael. It is a large city situated at the border of the kingdom of Nuruddin, king of the Turgamim. In other words, when he came there, this is Nur al-Adin was the ruler of Damascus. But he had not been the ruler yet of Egypt. King of the Turgamim, referring to the Turks. He himself was not a Turk, but he was part of he had wrested from the Turks, who are called Turks. It is a large and beautiful city, and is protected by a wall and surrounded all sides by gardens and orchards for a distance of 15 meals. There is no country on earth that produces such an abundance of fruit. And it continues on. This city contains some 3,000 Jews, many of whom are learned and rich men. It is a residence of the Rosh HaYeshiva of Eretz Yisrael. As we had, in the previous lecture, we said there had been, during the Gaonic period, there had been a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. During the upheavals in the 11th century, it moved first to near Tyre, then it moved to Damascus. So it was really the site of the yeshiva. Rabbi Ezra, whose brother Sar Sholem is the Av Beis Din, head of the rabbinical court. The other distinguished Jews are Rabbi Yosef, who ranks fifth in the yeshiva, Rabbi Tzliach, they had a whole, it seems, whole hierarchy. The Rosh HaSeder and Darshan, lecturer and expounder. Rabbi Meir, the pride of the rabbinic colleagues, and that was his title. Rabbi Yosef Ibn Pilath, who was the foundation of the yeshiva. These were different titles. Rabbi Haman, the Parnas, the community leader. Rabbi Tzadik, the physician. The city also contains some 200 Karaites and 400 Samaritans. They all live here on friendly terms, but they do not intermarry. So you have a whole contrast. We saw what Eretz Yisrael was, barely any Jews. And here we have Damascus, which is close to Eretz Yisrael. Is in all of this wealth. A decade or two after Rabbi Binyamin visited Eretz Yisrael, it was visited again by a traveler who made notes about his travels, but those notes are in no way as extensive as that of Rabbi Binyamin of Tudela. This was Rabbi Psache of Regensburg, a brother of the Baal Tosef of Rabbi Yitzchak Halovan. This account, actually it's not a direct account of his, but he had told it to someone else, and someone else is describing. So it's in the third person. This account, although much more brief, gives a further look into Jewish life of the period. And again, this is a third person account, so he had told it to someone else, and the other person is now relating. Rabbi Psache traveled to Damascus. It is a large city, and the king of Egypt rules over it. Remember, in the last thing, Rabbi Binyamin, it was only the king of the Turgamim, not of Egypt. So at the time, in 1163, when Binyamin came, Egypt was still under the rule of the Fatimids. 8 years later, however, Yusuf ibn Ayyub, known as Saladin, Nur al-Din's general, assassinated the last Fatimid ruler and took over Egypt in the name of Nur al-Din. In the year 1174, upon the death of Nur al-Din, Saladin claimed Egypt for himself and then went north with his army and took over Damascus, thus beginning this is Ayyubid dynasty. It would seem then that Rabbi Psache visited Damascus sometime after 1171, This is when the last Fatimid emperor was assassinated. But before 1187, where Saladin drove out the crusaders and invited Jews back to Yerushalayim. Because Rabbi Psache is describing Eretz Yisrael as being in the hands of the Christians. So we've narrowed it down, even though we don't have the exact date. There are about 10,000 Jewish inhabitants, and they have their own Nossi, or prince. Now, remember, Binyamin said 3,000. It isn't that many years afterwards. To resolve the contradiction, we have to say either Binyamin was only counting heads of households, those men, like units, and Rabbi Psache was counting total inhabitants, men, women, and children. Or, for some reason, which we don't know yet, the Jewish population of the city grew considerably between their visits. Binyamin, who wrote his account, of course, it was a private account. Today, if he would have written that account, it would have been all over and the people would have already started migrating there. So we can't explain it because he gave such a great description of it and everyone started moving there. So it's really not clear why why there's such a discrepancy, because it's not many years afterwards. And he continues on, Reb Sakya, the head of the yeshiva is Rabbi Ezra, again this is the same person who's in charge, who is full of knowledge of the Torah. He was ordained by Rabbi Shmuel ben Ali, the Rosh Yeshiva of Bavel. Now this Rabbi Shmuel ben Ali was a contemporary and a critic of the Rambam. He was the chief rabbi of Baghdad. Although Eretz Yisrael at the time was impoverished both physically and spiritually, as attested by the Rambam's account, which he read in the last lecture, which he was criticizing the, even though they had traditions, but he was saying that the level of scholarship was very poor. Damascus, however, was a flourishing Makom Torah, carrying on the tradition of the Torah scholarship of the original yeshivas Gon Yaakov that once existed in Eretz Yisrael proper. So it was a major Jewish center there, Damascus. And he continues on, Damascus is a fine land and lies in an area of gardens and orchards and high fountains from which water pours and many large pools. The water is very good and all kinds of fruits and sweets are available there. The Ishmaelites, the Arabs, say that if the Garden of Eden is on earth, then Damascus is the Garden of Eden. And he continues on. He traveled from there to the East Bank. In the land of Sichon and Og, no grass or vegetation grows. This is the contrast here. It's like Sodom and Gomorrah. Then he continues on. The Jordan River passes, now he's going to the headwaters of the Jordan. The Jordan passes through a cave, as the sages said. The Jordan begins at the cave of Banias, that's the Gemara in Basra and then Ayin Dalam and Beis, in 74b. He then came to Tiberias, Tiberia, which has a Jewish community. Even there, it's just so, there are Jewish communities, they don't number more than 100 or 200 or possibly 300 householders. We didn't see this from Binyamin, it really seems to be even much smaller. And we continue on, and from the descendants of Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, there was a young man, this is referring again to Tiberia, a bacher by the name of Rabbi Nehoroi, who has a son by the name of Rabbi Yehuda, after his forebearer, Rabbi Yehuda Anossi. He possesses a book of genealogy that traces ancestry back to Rabbi Yehuda Anossi. Rabbi Nehoroi was a physician and sold spices in the marketplace. His children are with him in his shop, but they are wrapped in a garment as not to look about. He is a Talmudic scholar and a righteous person, a tzaddik. Then he continues on, he visited Akko, there are Jews in Akko. He does not speak much about it. Rabbi Binyamin already said greater detail. Rabbi Psakia said that all of Eretz Yisrael can be traveled in 3 days. And he continued, he went to Jerusalem. The only Jew there is Rabbi Avram the dyer. Now, as we had that there were four dyers in the time of Binyamin, now there was only one. And he pays a heavy tax to the king to be permitted to remain there. Yeah. Now, evidently, changes occurred either in the Crusaders' level of taxation, which drove the other Jewish dyers out, as they could no longer afford to be in the city, or the others had simply passed on over the years. Now, after years of continuing warfare, Saladin finally defeated the Crusaders in the year 1187. That year, on the 27th of June, Saladin led an army of 30,000 against Tiberias, hoping to lure the Crusaders out of Jerusalem, because that was their main area. King Guy, the then current Crusader ruler over the Kingdom of Jerusalem, which included parts of today's Israel, Lebanon, and Jordan, got together 12,000 mounted knights, 15,000 infantry, and gathered at Sephoria, ancient Sipori. After a debate amongst his royal council, Guy decided to directly battle Saladin's troops
and relieve the siege of Tiberias. To that end, he marched his troops in sweltering heat and pitched his camp at a plateau between the two peaked horns of Hattin. The crusaders didn't bring along sufficient water, and the wells there were all dry. Suffering from thirst and heat, the crusaders awoke the next day to find the whole area in flames, as Saladin's troops had lit the scrubland around them. The Christian knights, determined to fight to the end, got on their horses and charged the Muslim army, who surprisingly simply opened ranks to let them through. Then sent a barrage of arrows that killed the crusaders' horses and left the knights tortured with thirst, exposed in their cumbersome armor. It was a rout. That just reminds me, there's a very famous battle in history that was waged outside of Carthage. And the Roman troops were there. And Hannibal's army came on elephants. And they attacked them. So what did the Romans do? Gave them a wide berth, and the elephants just passed through. And that was the end. And then they again, very similar to this. We'll continue on. King Guy's regular soldiers either died in battle, fled, or surrendered. Those 200 knights of the famed Templars or Hospitallers who weren't killed in battle, because basically they were all killed in battle, were taken prisoner. Saladin bought them from his men, as each one had taken one, to be a prisoner, to be a slave. He bought them for his men for 50 dinars apiece and offered them the opportunity to convert to Islam. Few accepted the offer. Remembering how the crusaders, those who wore the sign of the cross, had savagely butchered the Muslim residents of Jerusalem some 88 years before and then continued to kill Muslim troops all through the ensuing years, Saladin then asked for volunteers from the Sufi mystics and Islamic scholars from amongst his men, and gave them orders to kill those hated enemies of Islam. Thus was destroyed the glory of Christian Jerusalem. Evidently, the feelings of hatred that he harbored were so great that the bodies were not even given a burial, but were left to rot on the field. A historian recorded that even a year later, the battlefield remained covered with their bones. Amongst the regular troops, there are so many prisoners that were sold into slavery that the price of a Frankish slaves went down to only some 3 dinars. Remember, Saladin was willing to buy these troops for 50 dinars apiece. This is simply Adam Smith, supply and demand. It went down to 3 dinars, and one prisoner was bought for a shoe. From the horns of Hattin, Saladin led his victorious troops to conquer the remnant of the Crusader kingdom. Although they captured most of the cities of the coast, which up until then had belonged to the Christian kingdom of Jerusalem, they failed to capture Tyre, an important port city. From there, Saladin traveled on to Jerusalem. On September 20th, he surrounded the city and began his attack. By the 29th of September, Saladin's sappers were already digging trenches to undermine Jerusalem's walls. And the fall of Jerusalem was imminent. On the 30th of September, Balian, who is now the acting king of Jerusalem, went out to negotiate with Saladin. Saladin threatened Balian, quote, "We shall deal with you just as you dealt with the population of Jerusalem in 1099, with murder and enslavement and other savageries," end quote. Balian replied, quote, "Sultan, there are very many of us in the city. If we see death inevitable, we shall kill our children and our wives and pulled down the sanctuary of the rock in the El-Aqsa Mosque. End quote. At this, Saladin agreed to the following terms. With the exception of some noble women who were allowed to leave the city, the rest of the city was to be taken captive, and the captives would either be ransomed or sold into slavery. The ransom fee was 10 dinars a man, 5 per woman, and 1 per child. No one was allowed to leave Jerusalem without payment, although it seems that many bribed Muslims who let them down the walls in baskets and escaped, and others left in disguise. Balian paid some 30,000 dinars to ransom some 7,000 Christian residents. But the many thousands who could not afford the ransom payment and failed to escape were led away to slavery or concubinage. On the 2nd of October, Saladin himself entered Yerushalayim and ordered any Christian vestige be removed from the Temple Mount. Saladin himself, together with members of the royal entourage, personally scrubbed the Temple Mount with rose water. And then thus ended, at least at this juncture in history, Christian rule over Jerusalem. But the Christian world was not about to take this humiliating defeat passively. And thus, the Third Crusade was launched. In August of 1189, King Guy, the former king of Jerusalem, who had been graciously released by Saladin, led a small force against the fortress and port city of Acre, which was now in Muslim hands. Guy was soon joined by shiploads of German, English, and Italian crusaders. And they kept on coming. The leadership of this Third Crusade was being led by King Philip II of France. The Holy Roman Emperor Frederick I, known as Frederick Barbarossa, or Redbeard, and King Richard I of England, known as Richard the Lionheart. All of those who know about Robin Hood know about Richard and his brother John. Although Frederick I died on his way to Cilicia, in today's Turkey, by June of 1191, Richard joined Philip in their siege of Acre. In other words, but Acre had been besieged all these years. But both sides of Crusaders and Saladin's forces were exhausted from fighting. After the fall of Acre to the Crusaders, Philip returned home. Although Richard continued on south and recaptured Jaffa and moved on to Jerusalem, both armies were spent and their leaders were sick. Finally, in September of 1192, the Sultan Saladin and King Richard, the leader of the Crusader forces, signed the Treaty of Jaffa. The Christians recognized Muslim hegemony over Eretz Yisrael, with the exception of Acre and its environs, and the Muslims recognized the rights of Christians to visit the Church of the Sepulchre, the site, according to Christian tradition, where Yeshu was originally buried. On the 9th of October, Richard left for Europe, and there's an old story there. He was captured and had to be ransomed. Saladin retired to Damascus, where he contracted a fever and died on the 3rd of March in 1193. The kingdom of Yusuf ibn Ayyub Saladin was now fought over by his heirs. But finally, Saladin's brother, Safadin, the one who was involved in negotiations with Richard the Lionheart, became the Sultan. He gave over, however, the rulership of Jerusalem to his son, Muazzam, who rebuilt Jerusalem's wall with 7 colossal towers and renovated the city itself. By 1218, however, Muslim Jerusalem was once again imperiled, as John of Brienne, the new titular Christian king of Jerusalem, led what is known as the Fifth Crusade, and proceeded to capture the port city of Damietta in the Nile Delta of Egypt, just northeast of Cairo. fearing total collapse, the two sons of Safadin, Muazzam and Kamil, twice offered Jerusalem to the Crusaders if they would only leave Egypt. In other words, just leave Egypt, because Egypt was really the central place. Egypt was a wealthy area, and that was really their central place of the heirs of Saladin. I said, just leave Egypt, take Jerusalem.
Why was there a king, a Christian king in Jerusalem, if it was ruled over by?
Yeah, you're asking why was there a Christian king? It was a titular king. Guy had still been the king of Jerusalem, and he died. And this was he inherited the crown, so to speak.
But there was no.
You know, you do find that there are this is not a good example, but there are many Chassidish Rebbes that are Rebbes of Satmar, Sadegar, Boyan. These places don't exist anymore, but they've inherited the title. If you want to become a countess of something, it could be arranged. After this year, we'll talk about it. But this, so he was the titular king, and he said, you know, it belongs to me.
The Dalai Lama.
Yeah, well, yeah, he's no longer, so he's the Dalai Lama's, the leader of Tibet. The Crusaders hoping to conquer all of Egypt and then to victoriously go on to Jerusalem refused their offer. Fearing repeat of the terrible fate of Jerusalem under the original Crusaders, and also fearing the Crusaders' use of Jerusalem as a base of operations to dominate all of Syria, the two brothers made a fateful decision to tear down the walls of Jerusalem. So they tore down all of the walls of Jerusalem. Upon witnessing this scene and fearing the worst, Jerusalem's inhabitants soon fled the city. So the city was without walls and without inhabitants. But the fears of the sons of Safadin never materialized, as his fifth crusade fell apart when the Nile overflowed, blocking their entrance into Cairo. And the Crusaders realized the difficulty of achieving a quick victory left back to Europe, thus leaving Jerusalem in peace, but now without a wall. It would be over three centuries before another wall would be built around Jerusalem. That is the wall that you see today, which was built in the 16th century by the Ottoman Sultan Suleiman. Now, it seems that somewhere between 1216 and 1230, largely during the reign of Muazzam, Rabbi Yehuda al-Kharizi, a famed translator and poet, visited Eretz Yisrael. In his famed work, Tachkimoni, al-Kharizi describes life in Eretz Yisrael during this period. And this is on page 4. While I was in the middle of my journey, he's a poet, and everything is very poetic here. Right? Harboring feelings of anticipation, and yet with tears flowing from my eyes like a flooded river, I saw a man before me, a resident of the city of Jerusalem. He said to me, quote, "I believe you're from the diaspora, from foreign lands." End quote. I told him, true. That is true. And now I would like to ask you something. "I'm willing to help you," he replied. "Ask and I'll answer you." I then asked him, quote, "Since when have the Jews come to settle in this city?" He answered, well, "Since the time of the conquest of the Ishmaelites," this is referring to 1187, "Jews have lived here." I then asked him, "Why did they live here during the time that was under the rule of the uncircumcised?" referring to the Crusaders. He answered, "This is because they claimed that we killed their God and thereby humiliating them. Had they found a Jew amongst them, they would have swallowed him up alive. They echoed the sentiments recorded in the Torah. How can we sacrifice what is an abomination before their eyes without them stoning us? I then asked him, what brought you here to this place? He replied, because the Almighty was jealous of his name. He took revenge and took pity on his people, and he said, it is not right that the descendants of Esau should inherit my holy temple, and the sons of Jacob should be cast out. Lest the nations say, quote, the Almighty in his anger and his hatred rejected his firstborn son and raised the status of a son of a woman who was cast out. Was cast out to the station of a man, to the status of a man of a married woman. In other words, how does he, this, basically the Jews, in this narrative here, the Jews are God's chosen, they're the firstborn. How would the others favored over them? But he cannot grant firstborn status to the son of the beloved referring to the Christians at that time were given, had all the power, and deprived that lawful status from the son of the hated woman. It's very confusing. He keeps on changing who's the hated one and not. But basically he's saying that the Jews rightfully have the rights, even though their situation seems to be very very dire. Therefore, God aroused the spirit of the king of the Ishmaelites in the year 5950, which is really, excuse me, 4950, and I write sick, as really, as we said, it was 1187. According to this, it would have been 1190. From creation, it rests upon him a spirit of sound counsel and courage. And the king and his entire army arose from Egypt and laid siege to Jerusalem, and the Almighty handed it over to him, as we discussed before. And he ordered that the following pronouncement be made throughout the entire city to both those of high and low rank, quote, speak words of consolation to Jerusalem, letting her know that anyone of the seed of Ephraim, is Israel, whether they are the remnants from Ashur, I mean, it's coming from Iraq or Egypt, or from the ends of the heavens, are welcome to come, end quote. Consequently, they're gathered unto her from all corners as of Jews, and they settled within her border, and we are now settled in its tranquil and sweet protective environment. Al-Khurizi goes on to express his dissatisfaction with those Jews that made Jerusalem their home, castigating them in the worst terms. And again, just from a historical viewpoint, it's important to see this. As we will, in the succeeding lectures, we will continue to see echoes of this criticism of the Jews who lived in Jerusalem. And it continues on. Again, he puts this all in the words of this man that he happens to have met, who tells him this story. We are fearful, however, that it not soon come to an end, due to the evil deeds that is wrought in her midst and the violence and evil that are perpetuated therein, and because of the conflagration of hatred and dissension. The hearts of her inhabitants are divided, for they are all bitter and terribly cruel, each person desiring bad for his fellow man. A father despises his firstborn son, and so too the son his father. The sons collect the proverbial wood, and the father's desire to consume them with it. All of their actions are duplicitous. No one acts on behalf of the Almighty in heaven. Every single day the dissension argumentation becomes only worse, and all the hearts are divided. Consequently, I have called the name of this city, quote, the Rock of Dissension, end quote. The leaders are appointed over them, bite them with their teeth. One leader turns to harm his fellow leader, and the other one acts likewise. Each one is akin to thorns in the sides of his colleague. In addition, there are those amongst them that instigate others, both privately and publicly, and create divisions between brethren. Excuse me. This one casts his net, and his bow abides in strength, and the other increases their intensity of the bonfire and creates a conflagration. For that reason, we set before the Almighty our prayers to destroy the thorns from amongst us. May our eyes clearly behold this, and please remove from our midst this form of death.
He was talking about Jews?
He was speaking about Jews. Again, the timing of this is somewhere between the years 1216 and the years 1230. On the other hand, Al-Kharizi does describe a scholar that he meets in Sabah, in Sfas, in very warm terms. And he says here, on page 5, says, I passed by Safed Sfas, and I discovered there the chosen of God, a nobleman and a colossus, one who has the ability to straighten that which appears to be crooked, and to show the rightfulness of that which is correct, the Rosh Hashivas Gaon Yaakov, whose ancestors were the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Gaon Yaakov. He is a man of superb character. He has endured terrible calamities and many changes of fortune, has gone into exile. He still retains, however, his superb character without bitterness, without losing his quote-unquote fragrance. If he has lost the goodness that once accompanied his life, he is not lacking for those who would serve or respect him. May the Almighty, who has tested him with those difficulties, bind up his proverbial wounds and return to heal him. Now, Al-Kharizi spoke of the influx of Jews that came to Yerushalayim after Saladin's victory. It seems that one of the groups that came to Yerushalayim consisted of the elite scholars, Talmidei Chachamim, in France and England, led by the famed Rav Shimshon of Shantz, the author of many of the Tosfos and Shas, and the author of a classic commentary, a Pirish, to the Mishnayos of Seder Zroim and Seder Taras. The Mishnayos, the orders that deal with the agricultural laws and the laws of ritual purity. Now, let us read together from a tshuva, a responsum from Rav Shlomo Luria, the Marshal, dealing with the history of the Bali Tosfos. It's very interesting. It's in Simen Chof Tes. It deals with the history of that period, of the Rishonim. And he writes, after Rabbeinu Yitzchak of Dampir passed away, that's circa the year 1200, Rabbeinu Yitzchak ben Avroam served as Rosh Hashiva. You know, there are Tosfos that describe Rabbi Yitzchak of Dampir. They both have the name Yitzchak. As the Ri HaZokeh, the elder Rabbeinu Yitzchak, and the younger one is Ri HaBochor, the chosen, to distinguish between them. His brother Rabbeinu Shimshon subsequently went to Jerusalem. He passed away in a good old age and is buried at the foot of Mount Carmel. He was Dampir, which is in France. He was the leading Baal Tosfos. He was a great grandson of Rashi. Just to review this, Rashi had several daughters. One of his daughters, Yocheved, married Rabbi Meir of Ramarup. Rabbi Meir had three or four sons of great stature. One is the Rabbeinu Shmuel ben Meir, that's Rashbam. The Rabbi Yitzchak, there's Rabbi Yitzchak ben Meir, Rivom, who died young, and Rabbi Yaakov ben Meir, who was Rabbeinu Tam. He also had a daughter by the name of Miriam, who married a Talmud Chacham by the name of Shmuel, who was the son of Rav Simcha of Vitri. Rav Shmuel's son is this Rav Yitzchak, who's of Dampir. So both Rabbeinu Tam and the Ri, Rabbeinu Yitzchak, were the leading Bali Tosfos, the school of Tosfos. What?
Is Tam a
Rosh Hashanah
or something?
What?
Rabbeinu Tam. Tam is a Rosh
Hashanah. Yeah, Rabbeinu Tam, yeah, but it means Tam because Yaakov is Ishtam. So that's how he was named. He's a perfect man. So they couldn't, in other words, his brother was Yitzchak, so Rivom wouldn't work
too confusing. One is called Rivom. He has to be called something else. So to distinguish him, he is called Rabbeinu Thomas, and he was the greatest in that period. Yeah. We also find the following passage in the historical work, Shevet Yehuda, which gives us a little more detail. On the top of page 6, in the year 4, it's 4971. The year 5000 is equivalent to the year 1240. So it's 4971. Hashem aroused the spirit of the Rabbonim of France and England to travel to Jerusalem. There were over 300 scholars and their families. The great king, that would be Muazzam, the son of Safadin, a nephew of Saladin, or it would be Safadin himself, honored them, and they built their synagogues and study halls. Rabbeinu Yonasan HaKoyen of Luniel also went with them. A miracle occurred to them as they prayed for rain. They were immediately answered. The name of heaven was sanctified through them. It's no wonder, so we find this Rabbeinu Shimshon, we had moved and led this whole group. So it's no wonder we find in literature, the rabbinic literature, that he is called Rabbeinu Shimshon Ish Yerushalayim, as we quote. You can look at yourself. Another leader during this period seems to have been one of the Bali Tosfos, Rav Yosef ben Borach of Kaltzon, who is referred to in the literature as Yosef Ish Yerushalayim. Some of the Tosfos refer to this one as Yosef Ish Yerushalayim. Again, he was one of the leaders of the group of Bali Tosfos in Eretz Yisrael. It's interesting to note that when speaking about Yerushalayim, Rav Yehuda ibn Charizi doesn't make any note of the existence of a community of extraordinary scholars who lived there at the time. One wonders if those 300 scholars and families were still living in Yerushalayim when Al-Charizi visited there. And perhaps they fled when the walls of Yerushalayim were torn down by Safadin's sons, leaving the city exposed to the anticipated attack by the Crusaders. Or perhaps the very presence of such difficult and contentious elements of Jews in the city, as Al-Charizi described, that itself drove out these scholars and forced them to settle elsewhere. Another interesting question is how these scholars and their families supported themselves. Were money sent to them from Chutz Lorets, as was the case during the period when Yeshivas Gaon Yaakov was in Eretz Yisrael? Or as in later periods we had the Chalukah system, which we'll speak of in the future? Or did they come with specific skills that enabled them to be self-supporting? With the little information that we have regarding this period, it's difficult to arrive at any conclusion. Now, even though the Fifth Crusade, led by John of Brienne in the year 1218, ended in failure, Yerushalayim had not yet experienced its last crusade. In the year 1228, King Frederick II, the Holy Roman Emperor and the King of Sicily, and the son-in-law of John of Brienne, so again, he inherited the title, led to what is now called the Sixth Crusade. After arriving in Acre, the site of the now reduced Crusader kingdom, Frederick proceeded to march on to Jerusalem. Camille, the brother of the recently deceased Muazzam, who had by this time occupied Eretz Yisrael, was now involved in the struggle with Muazzam's sons over the fate of the rest of Saladin's empire. In order to avoid needless bloodshed, Camille agreed to cede Jerusalem and Bethlehem, the holy cities of Christianity, to Frederick together with a corridor to the sea. The Muslim Jerusalem, however, were allowed to retain the Temple Mount
with its holy Muslim sites, and were allowed complete freedom to enter there and worship. That was the compromise. So now Jerusalem was given over to the Christians. There are no historical records of any mention of the Jews in these negotiations, who it seems had by that time had largely fled the city. On March 17th, Frederick entered Jerusalem, was handed the keys of the city. Although Frederick soon left, Jerusalem was now again a Christian city, and Jews were again banned. In 1238, Tamil died, and Muazzam's son, Nasser Dawood, after defeating a new crusader army, marched into Jerusalem, besieged the Tower of David that had been turned into a crusader fortress, and after 21 days, on the 7th of December, 1239, Jerusalem again was in the hands of the Muslims. This victory was short-lived, however, as a new crusader army under Richard, Earl of Cornwall, and brother to English King Henry III, recaptured Jerusalem, negating the treaty that had been made by Frederick and Camille, and expelled the Muslims, and turned the Temple Mount into a Christian sanctuary. But even that victory was short-lived, as a new sultan, Salih Ayyub, in order to cement his claims as the rightful heir of Saladin, hired 10,000 Tatars, or Tartars, nomadic Turkic-speaking horsemen from Central Asia, who had been displaced by the new and growing Mongol Empire. But the sultan couldn't control these wild horsemen. And on July 11th, 1244, led by their leader Barka Khan, they raided Jerusalem, murdered its monks and nuns, and plundered the riches of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. After completely destroying Jerusalem, the Tatars finally left. And aren't we happy that Jews weren't allowed to be in Jerusalem? The Muslims re-entered this now deserted city, and Jerusalem would not be in Christian hands again until the defeat of the Turks by the British in 1917. All of this murder and plunder had not yet ceased, as in 1250, the Sultan Salih Ayyub and the royal entourage were assassinated by a group of his elite troops, the Mamluks, slaves whose origins were from Turkey and Caucasus, led by a former slave, Baybars, thus ending the Ayyub dynasty, the descendants of Saladin in Egypt, and the beginning of a new period, the dynasty of the Mamluks. Jerusalem itself still remained victim to repeated attacks as the Mamluks attempted to cement their hold on Eretz Yisrael. In the middle of all of this, in 1258, the Mongols, who had recently sacked the city of Baghdad, killing 80,000 and killing the caliph, captured Damascus and even reached Gaza. And they also plundered Jerusalem, leaving this already ruined city in further ruins. These were the Mongols. First we had the Tatars, now the Mongols. Finally, in 1260, a Mamluk army led by their general Baybars defeated the Mongols in Syria. Eventually, Baybars assassinated the Mamluk Sultan Qutuz, as he, before, Baybars was the one who had assassinated Salih Ayyub before him. But now, instead of giving it over to others, he was crowned Sultan. And you think Yerushalayim today has problems? You read about this and they... Under Baybars, Jerusalem began to rebuild, as men of wealth built palatial homes near the site of the Temple Mount. Even today, there are vestiges in Jerusalem of the Mamluk architecture. In his reign, Baybars successfully defended his kingdom from the Mongols and conquered much of what was originally the Crusader kingdom. Now, during this lecture and the previous lecture, we touched upon the terrible viciousness and immorality that prevailed amongst the warring parties for control of Eretz Yisrael, especially amongst their leadership. It is amazing to think, however, that in the midst of all of this in Eretz Yisrael was also, the home to some of the greatest personages of Jewish history. We briefly discussed the immigration, the Aliyah made by 300 of the Bali Tosfos, the leading scholars of France and England, led by the fame of Shimshon of Shans, in the year 1211. Almost 50 years later, another group left France for Eretz Yisrael, led by the Rav Yechiel, the Rosh Yeshiva of the great yeshiva in Paris. This is Rav Yechiel in Paris. Less than 20 years before that, in the year 1242, the French government, together with the church, claiming that Talmud is filled with anti-Christian bias, burned 24 cartloads of the Talmud and outlawed any further possession of copies of the Talmud. From that time on in France, the Talmud had to be studied from memory. As a result, after many feudal years, the yeshiva with its head, Rabbi Yechiel, moved to Acre. On page 7, says paragraph F, we quote from the Sefer Kafter of Ferah, which records a conversation with when Rabbi Yechiel was still in France, planning to move to Eretz Yisrael. There he described his plans of rebuilding, of at least offering korbanos in the Mokom HaMikdash. He hadn't come there yet to see the situation. Besides the many halakhic difficulties involved in bringing sacrifices in our times, some of which we'll again touch upon in this lecture, it would seem that Rav Yechiel entertained the thought that it was practically feasible to accomplish this. I would think that after he came there, and he saw firsthand the situation, that he perhaps reconsidered. Now, within a decade of Rav Yechiel's arrival, another giant of Torah made his way to Acre. This is Rav Moshe ben Nachman, the subject of a previous lecture. It says, upon arriving in Acre in the year 1267, he wrote the following. He wrote a letter. This is printed as an addendum to the Ramban's Nachmanides commentary to the Torah. Hashem has blessed me up until now that I married to come to Akko. I discovered there in the possession of the elders of the land a silver coin that was engraved on one side with a blossoming almond staff, on the other side with what seemed to be a flask. Around both sides was engraved writing that was clearly visible. They showed the writing to the Samaritans, and they immediately read it. For the Ksav Ivri, the ancient Hebrew or Phoenician script, remained with the Samaritans. They have their Sifrei Torah, as we said in a previous lecture many years ago, actually is written in the ancient Hebrew script, not the block letters that we have, Ksav Ashuri. The first Israeli stamps of the nascent state of Israel, their stamps were pictures of these coins. In a letter that he wrote to his son, says Nachman, I'm going to skip the beginning of this letter because of time, and go on page 8, in the second paragraph. What can I tell you regarding the land? For great is the abandonment and great is the desolation. Remember, this is coming sometime after the year 1267. The principle, that which is greater in its sanctity is greater in its devastation. The principle is that which is greater in its sanctity is greater in its devastation. Jerusalem is the most devastated of them all. And the devastation of the land of Yehuda, of Judah, is greater than that of the Galilee. But for all of its devastation, it's a very good place. There are close to 2,000 residents, about 300 of them are Christians, all of them survivors by the sword of the Sultan. Them survived the sword of the Sultan, I guess referring to all of the multiple invasions. There are no Jews here, as they fled at the time of the invasion of the Tatars, and some of them were killed by their sword. The only exception are two brothers who are dyers. Again, remember dyers. Who bought the rights of dying from the governor. On Shabbos, a small group gathers together with them, I guess they must be in surrounding villages, in their home to form a minyan, and they pray, they daven together. Behold, I encouraged them, and we found a desolate house, which was built with marble pillars and a beautiful dome, and we took possession of it to be used as a synagogue, for the city was Hefker, unknown, and anyone who wanted to gain possession of the ruins was allowed to do so. That was the government allowed them. We donated towards fixing up the house, and the work has already commenced. They also sent to the city of Shechem to bring back Sifrei Torah. Torah scrolls, originally from Jerusalem, were smuggled there when the Tatars came. Behold, they are now in the process of setting up the synagogue and will pray there on a permanent basis. For many are the people who are constantly coming to Jerusalem, men and women from Damascus, Aleppo, and all of the surrounding areas of the land to view the ruins of the Beis HaMikdash and to weep over it. He who gave us the opportunity to see Jerusalem in its ruined state will give us the opportunity to see it in its built and repaired state at the time when the glory of the Shekhinah will return. And you, my son, and your brother, and the house of your father shall merit to see the good of Jerusalem, the consolation of Zion. Sincerely, your father, who worries and forgets, now sees and rejoices. Yeah. During this period, it was the mid to late 13th century, life became increasingly difficult for the Jews in Germany. And we dedicated a lecture to them. And many contemplating moving to Eretz Yisrael. The Sefer Kolbo, written in the beginning of the 14th century, not long afterwards, quotes from a tshuva responsum for a mayor of Rutenberg, who responded to the question about moving to Eretz Yisrael. And really, and that is very enlightening here. Harav, this is on page 9. Harav Mayer of Rutenberg, wrote the following. Regarding that which you asked me to inform you about the essence of the mitzvah of traveling to Eretz Yisrael, the answer is that it is exactly as stated in the tractate Ksubas. We said this in the we covered this in previous lecture. And regarding your question, are all of the immigrants' sins forgiven? This is also explicitly stated at the end of the tractate Ksubas. It is dependent, however, whether the immigrant will be totally devout from that time on, i.e. the immigrant must refrain from transgressing any sin whatsoever, and he must fulfill all of the commandments that apply in Eretz Yisrael. For one who sins in Eretz Yisrael will be punished more severely than one who sins in Chutz Lartz, outside of Eretz Yisrael. This is because Hashem pays special attention to Eretz Yisrael, and the eyes of Hashem and his supervision is constantly directed towards Eretz Yisrael. One can't equate an act of rebellion which is performed in the palace of the king to a similar act which is performed outside of the palace. The land literally consumes its inhabitants, and as it is written, and the land shouldn't vomit you out, as if the Jews are immoral, for the land vomits out those who sin. This is the meaning of the verse, and your enemies who dwell in it shall be devastated. Even the members of the nations of the world who reside there will not be successful, for they too are wont to transgress sins. For that reason, Eretz Yisrael is now desolate and doesn't have even one city that's surrounded by a wall and well settled, as is the case in other cities. Regarding those who travel there and wish to act there in a light-headed, reckless, or contentious manner, and contentious who brings to mind the writings of El-Kharizi, apply the verse, but when you entered, you defiled my land. And the verse, and this verse is Jeremiah and Yirmiyahu, this is Yeshaya and Isaiah. Who has required this from your hand to trample my courts? End quote. To a person who travels there to conduct himself with sanctity and purity, there's no end to his reward. Provided, however, he's able to support himself. As is stated in chapter Ish Mikadosh in 50a, when one goes there, it is with the intention of settling, and it was about a question of a person who sold property, and he traveled, he sold his home,
He traveled to Eretz Yisrael, and he couldn't make it there financially, and he traveled back home. So this is what he's referring to. Regarding your question, why didn't the Gedolei Yisrael, great Torah scholars, I skipped them, travel there to achieve all that is stated regarding living in Eretz Yisrael? My answer to you is, they didn't simply forego this mitzvah. Their reasoning was that in order to travel to Eretz Yisrael, they would have to curtail their learning and to scurry about to provide for their needs, literally food. And we learned in Mishai Tziyuhu, there's an Arabian, that one is allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz Loretz, outside of Eretz Yisrael, in order to study Torah. Most certainly then, one is not required to leave his Rebbe, his master, to travel from Chutz Loretz to Eretz Yisrael. And most certainly, if it will lead to curtailment of his studies and force him to scurry about to provide for his needs. Regarding that which you asked me to explain to you, the statement of Chazal, our sages, one who dwells in Chutz Loretz as if he has no God, this explanation is that the principal divine presence is in Eretz Yisrael. His glory resides in Eretz Yisrael with the divine throne situated opposite the human throne. As is written, pray to you, says, towards their land. As they pray to this is Shlomo, King Solomon, is referring to the Jews, wherever they are, will pray to you towards their land. It is also written, Talpios, this is a tale to Shekola Pius, poignant, says the turrets, the elevation, which all mouths, says Pius, turn. This is because the Shekhinah really rests, the focus of this connection is in Eretz Yisrael, in Yerushalayim, the Kodesh HaKadoshim. From there it spreads out. So in that sense, it's considered one who dwells in Chutz Loretz, he has less of a connection to the Shekhinah. Now, although Akko merited to have such a prestigious Jewish presence, as the Bali Tosfos were there, Ramban was there. Ramban really actually visited Yerushalayim, but he settled in Akko. In the citations, we have the drusha that he gave on Rosh Hashanah to the yeshiva there, to the people in Akko, and many of them were. Students were from the Bali Tosfos, who had been students of the great masters. It was unfortunately short-lived. As the Mamluks, the members of the dynasty of former slaves who succeeded Babars died in the year 1277, finally realized Babar's dreams, and on the 18th of May 1291, this is some 21 years after Ramban passed away. They finally broke through the Crusader defenses of Acre, killing most of the defenders and enslaving the rest, thus ending forever any vestiges of the once powerful Crusader kingdom, as well as one of the most prestigious Jewish communities on earth. It would be many years until a Jewish community Eretz Yisrael of such stature would arise. That is the subject of a coming lecture. In the interim, however, Eretz Yisrael was still blessed with outstanding personages, some mere visitors and other permanent residents. One of these was Rav Ashtori HaParchi. Some understand this unusual name, Eshtori, to simply be his secular legal name. His real name was Rav Yitzchak Ben Moshe. Others understand it actually to be a descriptive name, Eshtori, an explorer. The word Haparchi, literally the Florentine or flower, derives from his family's ancestral birthplace of Florenza, Spain. When the Jews were expelled from France in 1306, Rav Ashtori, who was living there at the time, left France and traveled to Spain and Egypt and finally settled in Eretz Yisrael in the city of Beit Shan and supported himself as a physician. He was the first to thoroughly research the topography of Eretz Yisrael and identified 180 locations mentioned in Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, and the Talmud. In his oft-quoted writings,
in which he thoroughly analyzes the special laws that apply to life in Eretz Yisrael. He quotes on occasion names of other scholars who lived concurrently in Eretz Yisrael. Evidently that even after the fall of Akko, Eretz Yisrael still contained within it men of stature. Not, of course, the great amounts before, but there were still men of stature. Time doesn't allow me to read through this, but he mentions he was close to a particular Rabbeinu Boruch. This Rabbeinu Boruch had studied under Rav Meir of Rutenberg. He was living in Eretz Yisrael, and he shared much important information with him. He was the one who told him about Rav Yechiel's dream of Paris to go to the Temple Mount and to sacrifice. And he explains here, this is on page 11, the author of the Kafir Ferah, whoever's story, his own critique. Here, this is on paragraph section C on page 11, number 2, that there were, everyone is tome, everyone has come in contact with a dead body at a funeral, whatever. Says, how could they enter the Temple Mount? He had another problem. How do you find a Kohen Miyuchas? This is a problem of the Yichas of Kohanim. Even if they would be tested as a true Kohen, but if the mother had an affair before she gave birth, if the mother was divorced before she married the father of the Kohen, or had an affair it would affect the child. So there's a question of A, are they descended from Aaron HaKohen? And B, and even if they are, are they pure? So because of these things, where are they going to find someone that they could rely on as a Kohen Miyuch? These were the problems that he brought up. But again, he basically leaves this. But that there were, and he speaks about that there were other scholars there in Eretz Yisrael. He quotes Rav Amram, but it no longer became a central place at that point. I would just like to end here with a fascinating tshuva from Rabbeinu Nissim. The Rabbeinu Nissim, the Ram, Gerundi, which is in Catalonia, which is in eastern Spain, was the leading, in the middle of the 1300s, he was the leading Talmudic sage. Rabbeinu Nissim, the Ram. He is widely studied in the yeshivas. His work on Masechta Devarim is really the commentary. This is the most widely studied commentary. But his works on the Talmud itself and the Rabbeinu Alfas are widely studied. He deals with the following question. I'm just going to summarize this. But he deals with the following problem. He was asked by another Rav this question.
What year was this?
We don't, but it's circa the year 1340. So we're going down circa the year 1340.
And
this was, it's hard to know. But this is around Barcelona. This was in Spain. But he was asked by the Rav to whom this question was given. He was the rabbi's rabbi, the Ram. The problem was, there are three friends. They made an oath that they are moving to Eretz Yisrael. Not actually told Eretz Yisrael, because they don't know if they'll be able to live in Eretz Yisrael, because they described all these difficulties. Okay, now, I mean, it was full of wars upon wars and devastation. But maybe they would move close to Eretz Yisrael, to Damascus, to Cyprus, Alexandria, and visit from time to time. So at least they can make pilgrimages, even if they're not in Eretz Yisrael. They weren't sure what the situation is. But they made an oath, they're leaving home. And they made the oath in a way, they structured it, that normally an oath can be annulled if one goes and finds grounds that, had I known this or had I known that, I have complete regret. the oath could be annulled. They made it, they structured it in a way that they could only be annulled with the consent of all of these, in a way that they had given up their right for annulment, were annulled with the consent of others. So it was very difficult to annul this oath. One of them, whoever made this oath, the wife refused to go. And she would not accept the divorce document. So if he left her, he would leave her in Aguna. What should he do? Had he known this, he would have never made this oath. But yet he has no right now by law to annul it based on him. So what should he do here? And not only, perhaps they were Sephardim and they were not bound by the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom, but Catholic law then did not allow them to divorce a wife against a wife's will. They were stuck. What should I do? I made this oath, and we're all together, and the ship is about to leave. And she's not coming. You know, this reminds me of the story, you know, we said this in the class before, about this Boy Scout who comes home all bloodied. And the mother says, "What happened to you?" "Well, you know, I'm a Boy Scout. And we're supposed to help old ladies cross the street." "Yeah." "Well, she didn't want to go." So what should he do here? That's the question he asked this Rav. And then the Rav went and asked Rabbeinu Nissen. So he says, this is a very difficult question. But my feeling is, and this is what you can read this yourself, my feeling is this oath is not valid. Because you can't make an oath to leave your wife in Aguna. There's no such a mitzvah. Now there is a law that one could perhaps force one's wife to move to Eretz Yisrael, which we've covered before, to move to Eretz Yisrael. And perhaps he was in the right to make such an oath because he has the right to, and if she doesn't want to go, he would give her a get and she would lose her ksuba. But here they had not made an oath to go to Eretz Yisrael, to move, lived in Eretz Yisrael. They made an oath to move to the Middle East, to one of the areas around there, perhaps Eretz Yisrael or Alexandria or Damascus or Cyprus, somewhere where they are able to visit Eretz Yisrael. So since that was not an oath to actually go move to Eretz Yisrael, he feels that this is an oath which is against the Torah because he has no right to force his wife to leave. He can't leave abandon his wife, and therefore he feels that the oath is not valid and he could stay put. But this gives you a sense of the feelings of the people who were willing to make the sacrifice to go there. But this was the situation as it was during this period. As Emir Tashem says, we'll continue the saga of life in Eretz Yisrael in this pre-modern era in the next lecture. Are there any questions? Yeah.
I have two questions on the account of Benjamin Segal. First one is, three walls around Yerushalayim? What happened to
them? You know, these manuscripts are, you're asking about the three walls. Some of these manuscripts are defective. You know, and he could have gimel, you know, he could have written a dalet in some way that the one who copied this, like, because it originally, you have to realize, this was a handwritten manuscript. And then copyists kept on, this is before Xerox, remember. It was written by someone else. Not everyone's handwriting is so legible. So it could be that the original was dalet, but the manuscript that was reproduced, said three.
Second question on Benjamin of Tudela. He doesn't seem to have read Josephus, in that he thought that what we call the Western law was holy in some way.
Yeah, you're asking about Benjamin of Tudela said he didn't read Josephus. I don't know how many Jews in the world read Josephus. At that time, it was preserved by the church.
And it was written in I don't even know if the Greek was preserved. It was preserved in Latin. The original was written in Greek, but I don't know if that was preserved. It was written in Latin, preserved by the church. It was only really until the modern era that it was really became the domain of world scholars.
How did the Temple of the Rock survive when they had all these Christians that came and destroyed?
The Dome of the Rock, during the Christian period, they put a cross on top of the Dome of the Rock. So it doesn't take much. You know, so that's how, if you go to downtown, if you go to Detroit, you'll find many churches with Mogen Dovids. This is how it survived.
They don't even change anything in those churches either.
What?
They don't even change anything inside of them. They just stick a cross on them.
Yeah, they probably have all the plaques. I remember
some of them do actually, believe it or not.
Well, I remember I brought my mother, Allah Shalom, this is many years ago. I was helping her so when she was still alive and she was still living in Los Angeles, and the Jewish neighborhood had moved from the east, what's called the east side of Los Angeles, East Los Angeles, which is a very dangerous place, to the west side. But I grew up as a boy on the east side in Boyle Heights. So I took, and we had to go to a specific Sears store that was in the east side. So the one that the closest had closed down. So I took my mother there. I had never driven there when I was a little boy. And I had the directions, but I made one wrong turn. And I came close to the old neighborhood where I grew up. I said, "Ma, let me see the house, you know what?" So I came and I passed my house, and it was a lot smaller than I remembered it. And then I turned the corner. I want to see the shul that I used to daven in. And it's a church today. But they have the stone, the dedication stone in Hebrew, like that's on the... I remember there's a little house behind the shul where I used to eat shalashudas, you know. It was a very nice, you know, that's what happened. Yeah, so that's what happened to the Dome of the Rock. A good tevach.